hubbo!
How are you, hubbo?
I'm hanging in there, Micah.
Like a hair in a biscuit. Are you prepared to learn the truth about UFOs?
Doing finer than frog hair.
Hubbo.
Two.
Hubbo. You know, the chat worked just fine a little while ago, and now all of a sudden it's going back to not...
It works just fine all the time. You gotta upgrade your crap.
Well, I did, is the funny thing. I upgraded all three of them, and it still won't work in any of my browsers. Or on my Windows unit,
crap.
Either. So why is it not working on my Windows machine?
Crap.
But it worked perfectly, like 2 weeks ago. Everything loaded, it was fine, there it was. And then...
Crap.
Now the chat has gone back to not being functional.
Interesting.
Could this somehow be related to the truth about UFOs?
UFOs.
The legend. The legend of Hubbo.
Oh, man. Hey, I've got this cool new thing. Check this out. You ready for this?
Yep.
Here, listen to this.
Pray continue with your fascinating narrative.
I've got a new audio soundboard. Huh?
Play that one for Kevin Randall.
Listen to this one right here.
Wow! The land of make-believe!
That's excellent.
Uh-oh. What is that? Is that the countdown? No. Okay.
Fooled you.
You fooled me. Hey, Hubbo.
Yeah.
Hubbo, here's another good one. Let's see here. Ready for this?
Pentagon's like, how do we get the jellyfish into total war? Dance around and prance.
I think that's one of the all-time best.
Oh, my God.
What is he even talking about? How do we get the jellyfish into total war?
He's lost his mind.
It has finally left his brain.
Here's a good one. Ready? Here we go.
You ever hear the expression, too close for comfort? That was damn uncomfortable.
He finally something more than giggles.
Oh, yes.
10 seconds before sweep here.
I'm going to try this new audio interface. Let's hope it works, eh? Yeah?
Bet any disease.
This is always fun.
Alternative talk radio.
In 5.
Sending.
4.
Bye.
3. 2.
Geronimo.
1. Jump over the boat.
Fantastic.
Is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, where the ground is still shaking after what happened this weekend. More on that in a moment, but for right now, I am yours truly, Micah Hanks, and that means this is the Grillion Report. Welcome once again as we keep you company here in space-time, as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via the wonders of the KGRA radio network. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of traveling. I'm always doing a lot of traveling. I'm a space-time doctor. It's really all I seem to do anymore. And yeah, I'm not kidding. Things have been extremely shaky here in the bunker for more reasons than one. One being, in fact, that we're actually testing a brand new audio interface, and let me tell you, it is working like a charm so far. Anybody got any wood? You want to knock on it right now. Let's hope things continue to go as smoothly as they are thus far. Later in the program, we're going to be remembering a rock icon and his esoteric interests. And we're also going to be getting to a few belated messages from those of you out there. info@MicahHanks.com. You can reach me if you'd like to send along your own thoughts, ideas, perspectives, criticisms, or even news stories that we might cover here on this program. We've also got some discussion about the distinction between UFO and UAP, and also a mystery that has been bouncing around on the World Wide Web now for a number of years. Back in the news, we still don't know what it is, but we do love mysteries on this show. We don't merely pander mystery fodder. We do try to seek a logical basis for understanding the weird world in which we live. Weird in part because of those with whom I associate. One good example, I think, point in case, right here on this program. None other than the mystery man named
Mr. Hobbs, or Hobbo, who, back in Master Control, joins us gleefully as he always does. How are you, Mr. Hobbs?
Hobbo.
I've got a good...
I'm dandy.
You are a dandy. I do know that. There's no disputing.
I've been shopping for one of these futuristic UFO houses that float on the sea, and I can travel the world in it. Have you seen these yet?
Yeah, I did. I had that linked in the Graylian Daily News. It's funny that you bring that up because I've been looking at that. Yeah, UFO houses, there are some interesting designs that have existed. When I was down on the Outer Banks a few years ago, Race, one of these stylized UFO-type homes was sitting right by the side of the road. And what's so funny is it was no longer in use, but it was on somebody's property, and I think they used it for like a clubhouse or something. And they had these little faces, these alien-looking monsters peeking out of the window. So if you got close enough to the thing... And the great thing is that they glowed in the dark, too. So if you went by at night, you'd see them glowing. But, yeah, these little alien faces were peering and leering out at you.
Oh, how funny would that be?
Yeah, it really would be. So,
glow in the dark, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it'd be trippy.
Now, the one you're talking about, though, is a little different, right? This is actually a floating UFO home, correct?
Yeah. It's got soil and everything.
Oh, so you can know? Have a little
it's
garden.
It's like a golf ball with this big... halo around it, and you know, it's got a bedroom, a kitchen, bathroom. It's got all the amenities, and it's all solar powered and just self-contained, and you can literally maneuver this thing in the water like a boat. And not very fast from what I understand, but does a couple of 2 or 3 knots, but it can, you know, you could literally travel the earth via the sea. I don't know how well it does in like, you know, rough seas or whatever.
Right.
But it sure is an interesting design, this jet capsule. It's really cool.
Well, you know, one of these days, maybe rather than a luxury yacht, maybe I'll just go ahead and get one of these floating UFO homes. It sounds like the kind of thing that I would have, right?
$200,000.
$200,000. Yeah, maybe I'll hold off.
For that price, we'll get 2 or 3.
Yeah, of course.
Hell, this price, we'll just pick up 3 or 4.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, I've got this long-term plan, which I can't divulge the details here, but, you know, I do plan to build a TARDIS one day. And so, yeah, I'm going to have to be saving up for that. I don't know if I can go all in on the UFO home, the floating UFO home.
I'll get the home, you get the TARDIS, we'll travel the world.
Yes, and all of time and space. Just as well, my friend.
The multiverse.
Well, so it's interesting because do you remember a few weeks ago on this show, I reported that there was a mystery boom, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was right outside of Asheville where this was reported.
Yep.
And subsequent to that report, it was kind of weird because I'd initially said, well, you know, the area where they're describing that this mystery boom seemed to emanate from, the area that people were describing where this was heard, was in the North Asheville area, actually closer to the next town over, which is Weaverville. And years ago, there was a report of a shallow earthquake that occurred there, and a lot of people said that they felt the quake. Some people heard a loud boom associated with that. And I, initially, when I heard this report, had thought to myself, well, you know, maybe this was another shallow earthquake. Well, then I heard, as we talked about on the show, that the FBI had been investigating this alleged mystery boom, and that got me really interested, but it turned out not to be quite as interesting as I'd hoped. The FBI were investigating, apparently, some sort of property damage near the area, I'd say a good several miles away, but nonetheless, relatively near the area where the boom was reported, and they said that there was a lot of tractor, you know, farm equipment, tractors and stuff on this job site that had been peppered with bullet holes, and it looked like what they had done was someone had set off an explosive from afar by actually shooting at it with a rifle or a shotgun, and that this may have been the boom that people were reporting, and hence why the FBI was now investigating.
Hmm.
Well, then while I'm traveling down there in Texas with Cam and Kyle and coming up to see you in Eureka Springs, T-Pitt, Mr. Tyler Pittman, one of our fellows here at the Graylian International, he actually sent me a message and said our mystery boomer is back at it. And I said, has there been another explosion or an attack on the job site? And he said, no, once again, this was just a mystery boom that was reported. And he sends along the link, and I thought, okay, but this time there was no explosion associated with it, huh? Well, just before I went to air, I actually found this, and I was quite surprised to read that WLOS right here in Buncombe County is reporting that the USGS... apparently upgraded an earthquake that shook parts of northern Buncombe County early this morning from a 2.2 magnitude to a 2.5. And listen to what they said. They said, according to the USGS, it happened about 3 miles northwest of Weaverville just before 10:45 a.m. Exact same location. I mean, it's the exact same area. So again, I'm beginning to feel a little justified that perhaps the previous mystery boom reports were what I had predicted that they would have been at the outset, that they were shallow earthquakes. Now,
Well, thank God we had the FBI on the job.
Well, again, this is the thing, is that I find that with these mystery boom reports, if you really dig into the literature, and you know, again, most listeners of this show, I mean, we've got a lot of new ones. As a matter of fact, I'll just say right now, I think we've already talked about this, but the downloads for the month of April almost doubled over the course of that month. And, you know, Race, you'll see that that will tend to happen when you go out to these events, you know, and you get out and you meet people and you travel places. You'll actually see that the word of mouth builds, and you'll get new listeners, and they'll tell friends, and they'll tell friends, and they'll tell friends. We also made a lot of the back catalog of this program available on iTunes, a lot more than was already available. And the combination of all of the aforementioned have really boosted our numbers over the last month. So we've definitely had a lot of downloads, but there are, of course, as I'm alluding here, new listeners. And so those who are not aware, if you're interested in these strange sounds in nature, we're going to be talking about another one here in just a second. We've got some interesting audio of that. But I've got a whole website dedicated to this called mysterybooms.com. And when you familiarize yourself with the scientific literature about this subject, you begin to kind of note the little patterns and the consistencies between reports. So when they were describing what was heard initially about a month ago up there in North Asheville, again, knowing that there's a history of shallow earthquakes in that region, I mean, the Brevard Fault actually runs right through this area. And I initially thought this probably was one of these shallow earthquakes that caused this mystery boom. The FBI came in because there happened to be this destruction of property that was, again, I'd say maybe, you know, 15 or 20 miles away. Now, it's not impossible by any means that the boom would have been heard over that great distance, but I mean, there were a lot of people a good distance away that I'd begun to wonder, especially with the shape of the landscape around here with the mountains and the hilly region in which we live. I really begun to wonder if it was likely that people that far away would have heard the little explosion that occurred at this job site in Woodfin. Sure enough, there was another boom, and now USGS is reporting an earthquake that happened just this morning, and that one is actually on record. A lot of these shallow earthquakes, though, they're so small, a boom may occur, people may hear a noise, they may even feel shaking, but it may not register, and the USGS doesn't always have relevant data to accompany those reports. Now, the Buncombe County EOC this morning reported that they'd taken a few calls, and get this, people had reported hearing what sounded like thunder, but there were no reports of damage. So once again, there were thunder-like sounds reported in accompaniment with this small earthquake there that the USGS actually did log and upgrade to a 2.5 magnitude. Pretty interesting. And I found out about that just before we went to air. So once again, I feel somewhat vindicated. It seems to me that indeed there have been a lot of little tremors in this area, but that's kind of unusual. We don't have a lot of those, and for there to have been a succession of little tremors here in North Carolina, I mean, I'm not exactly certain how often they are reported or how often people in that region may hear them when they go unreported. But it is interesting. I wonder if it actually may have something to do with the time of year, because, of course, it's getting really warm in the daytime this time of the year, but at night it can get pretty cool. And while I was traveling down in Texas, we had a lot of evenings where the temperature probably got down into the 30s and 40s. Right now, the temperature today, I think, is about 66 degrees. It probably got up close to 70, but, you know, tonight it's going to get all the way down into the lower 50s. So with those temperature variants of the warm days and the cool nights, it can cause that the expanding and contracting. And another little interesting tidbit about that, some theories about what may cause the illuminations that are reported nearby in the Linville Gorge, the Brown Mountain Lights, some theories hold that it may be that same, expanding and contracting as a result of the heat and the cold differential between night and day that may lead to stresses which could be conducive to the formation of some sort of a natural luminous phenomena there in the gorge. And what's funny is now Professor Dan Caton he's an astronomer and a professor at the Appalachian State University nearby. He is very interested in the idea that there may be something akin to ball lightning-type plasmas or earthquake lights in that area. A number of years ago, he had been a little bit more cynical and a little more skeptical about that idea. I remember I was giving a lecture. I was in my early 20s, and I must have looked like some sort of little, young dummy. And I'm up there, and he was in the audience, and he was very skeptical of the idea that whatever was happening in the gorge or any other kind of apparent anomalies in nature might be relative to temperature differentials between night and day. And I remember he stood up in the middle of my lecture and asked why I thought that temperatures could be conducive to the formation of these weird phenomena. But more and more as time goes on, we are finding that there are links between seasons, temperature, fault zones, geophysical phenomena, and not only sounds, anomalous sounds in nature, but also apparent illuminative phenomena. So, once again, I'm not trying to say I predicted all this, but really I think you have to have a fairly open mind. And also I think you have to have an interest in a lot of different areas of science. You can't get too tunnel visioned, so to speak. You can't get, you can't look just in one direction all the time. You have to be willing to look at various literature. You'll start to find interesting little connections between them. Now, on that note, Sean, one of our listeners, had written to me, and this, I'm going to read his email because it's quite funny. I'm going to read this verbatim. He said, "I haven't heard this, Hobbs, myself, but wow, the recording is quite, Hobbs, intense. Is this a different phenomena than the booms, Hobbs? Sending much cosmic love, Sean Sobon." Hubbo. He actually wrote all of that into the email there. Race? Race? Are you there?
Yes. I didn't want to open my mic because the air conditioning just turned.
Well, that's okay. I thought you might appreciate the Hobbs.
Hobbs.
Now, what Sean actually links to is interesting. A different kind of weird noise that is being referred to as the Windsor hum. Okay, now we do have an audio clip. It is an extremely low-frequency audio clip, and so depending on what kind of headgear you may be using, if you're listening to this at home, I know a lot of people use the iPhone earbuds, but some people just play it right off their computer, so depending on what you have, you may or may not be able to hear this, but I don't want to rattle anybody's windows, so I'm going to give you advance warning here in a moment. We're going to hear an audio soundbite that is actually the specific frequency that was captured. And then it was isolated, this frequency of this strange hum that's being reported. But this was actually reported, I believe, at weather.com. They're saying people in Windsor, Ontario aren't alone in perceiving a mysterious hum just beyond the range of hearing in most people. And though it may not be related, people all over the world, in fact, around 2% of the population, according to the Tech Insider website, have reported some kind of unexplained hum. But get this, now of all places, New Republic magazine reported on this. Writer Colin Dickey actually had turned to a Canadian source for information on the hum, which can be seen, or which can seem so intense to some people that it has been driving them mad. Dickey had tracked to the Gibsons, British Columbia area to speak with a gentleman named Glenn McPherson, who helps people track worldwide manifestations of these weird hums on a special website. Now, variances of this reported around the world. There is a similar hum that occurs in southwestern England. There is, of course, the famous Taos hum. There are a lot of locales where people report hearing these weird hums. And it really is everywhere, apparently, according to Dickey, who wrote the following in New Republic. It's in Overland Park, Kansas, where it sounds like a metallic sound or something vibrating. It's in Kara, Turkey, where it's a very deep and quiet rumble that sounds like a very distant diesel generator. In Hervey Bay, Australia, there's what's described as a pulsing, continuous, low-background aircraft rumble that doesn't go away. It seems to show up mostly in rural areas and in small cities. More people have heard it in Boise, Idaho, than in Washington, D.C., but both localities nonetheless report it. Now, it's pretty interesting because there are theories about what may be the underlying cause of these hums. Some people have described these hums, especially out near the Colorado Rockies when they are reported, as sounding like some sort of an engine rumbling underground. And it has led some people to believe that these are actually the construction of vast tunnel networks under the United States or underground bases of some variety. Now, there's maybe not so much evidence that actually substantiates that, but again, it seems logical if you sense what appears to be a vibration and you hear a hum that appears to be coming from below ground, well, maybe somebody's down there doing something, right? Now, McPherson's website apparently deals with these reports from North America and Western Europe, particularly those in the UK that we mentioned a second ago, but apparently there's an amateur researcher. Well, I'm sorry, I guess we're talking about McPherson here, who warns people that the concentration on those areas is likely because the site is in English, he says. In other words, the fact that the website is in the English language lends to the apparent concentration in those areas. He believes that in parts of the non-English-speaking world, the hums are just as prevalent. So why don't we go ahead and get to a little bit of audio of this alleged Windsor hum. This is, again, very low frequency. If you have, for instance, just your computer speakers, the built-in laptop speakers, you probably wouldn't hear this. With earbuds, you probably will. This is what they say the Windsor hum sounds like. I'm going to pot this up very slowly so that you can hear it. Here it goes. Okay, there you go. You can hear it's a very, very low-level hum. And that should give you an idea. Once again, the Windsor hum, this is what people report hearing in various vicinities. Now, you could imagine something like that being probably kind of disconcerting. I think that there are probably instances where it would even be unsettling to some people. And weather.com reports that as much as it would be awe-inspiring to know the Windsor hum is a local manifestation of some kind of global phenomena, apparently now there's evidence that it's not. And this is why they say so. In 2013, a team at the University of Windsor actually set up a recording station in an area woodlot, and the audio recording that you're hearing right there is apparently a portion of what was recorded. They say that it actually, probably, they felt that this sound was emanating from a nearby source, Zug Island in the River Rouge, Michigan. Now, if that's the case, they said it may be separate from the so-called world hum that is reported elsewhere. According to CBC News, locals who have heard the Windsor hum are convinced it's a separate phenomenon. Resident Mike Provost told the CBC he was certain the source was a steel plant on heavily industrial Zug Island and is different from other unexplained sounds, but in any case, its effects, as he describes them, sound very unpleasant, kind of like what you're hearing just now. He says it rattles everything, including your body, your stomach, everything. You get headaches. He says there's stress in your shoulders, your neck, your ears. Your ears will pop because of the sound. Your ears always seem like they're kind of plugged up. For all we know, apparently, coming back to Mr. McPherson, who runs the website, for all we know, all those reports from Windsor and La Salle and that general area are being confounded by people who hear the world hum. As for what the world hum actually is, there are a great deal of possible explanations. Now, you know, we've talked about this again a bit in the past, and I've written about it at Mystery Booms. One theory for the so-called world hum, rather than being some sort of a localized source, as some have speculated, the world hum may be the result of deep sea ridges on the ocean floor, that deep ocean currents and waves as they pass over them cause a vibration which can be felt in different regions of the world. That's one theory as to what may actually be happening. Apparently, Windsor is just one example of places where this hum is reported. We've talked about a lot of the others. The Tech Insider notes a persistent humming noise can be a symptom of tinnitus just as well, and that some people may not actually be hearing a hum, but they may be experiencing an inner ear phenomena. There was a study released in 2015 that suggested sufferers may be hearing the vibration of, once again, ocean waves. And again, if this is the case, it wouldn't at all be the only instance of a specific natural phenomena emitting a highly specialized noise or the lack thereof. You know, in fact, in the realm of public alerting, earlier this year, MIT scientists even announced a way that deep ocean sound waves might be used to detect tsunamis, potentially saving lives. And so, again, the apparent noises that are produced by deep ocean waves and whatnot might be useful, apart from the fact that they drive people nuts, if indeed they are responsible for the hums people are reporting. But on that subject of tsunamis, you know, over the weekend, there was a tsunami warning device about 200 miles off the coast of New Jersey, and it went into event mode over the weekend. Apparently, it registered a pretty significant drop. And yes, immediately people were concerned, oh my God, is there a tsunami on the way? Unfortunately, that was not the case. That according to information at the website of the National Data Buoy Center. The website noted an ocean buoy out in the Atlantic recorded a big drop. It was about 88 feet, the same number of keys on a full piano. And apparently this occurred at about 6:38 p.m. local time on Saturday. It was quickly followed by a huge rise of 180 feet. Understandable why they might have been concerned, huh? Now, there was speculation that the drop might have been triggered by a meteor. Did you know that meteors could do that? Yeah, here we were in the middle of the Lyrid meteor showers, which were active over the weekend. Some people thought that the meteor might have actually caused it, but that wasn't the case. There was also speculation, and this is a little more tantalizing, that a submarine passing nearby might have caused it. However, the mystery was solved when the National Data Buoy Center, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they apparently reported that workers were out there doing routine maintenance on that buoy, and they pulled up the bottom pressure recorder, which is why the ocean level readings were abnormally high there for a moment. They said this routine maintenance caused a data spike there on the National Data Buoy Center's website, although there was no tsunami threat that was ever present. In the event of a real tsunami threat, NOAA's tsunami warning centers will alert the public. Apparently, the public wasn't alerted, but again, I can't help but think that there might have been somebody out there sitting at home on Saturday evening doing what they always do on their weekends when they've got a little time off. They were heading right on over to the National Data Buoy Center website, and there for a moment they might have choked on their rum and coke. Fortunately, it was a false alarm, huh? Yeah. And before we go to the break here, I just want to tease, there's been something else on the minds of many people just as well. And that has been this mysterious object that has been observed beneath the Baltic Sea. You may remember we reported on this a while back, and I think just about every news program that covers science and the unexplained, probably known to humankind, has already talked about this. It was dubbed the Baltic Sea Anomaly. And it, according to many accounts, looks kind of like a giant saucer. Some people will tell you it looks like the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars. It was discovered 5 years ago by a Swedish group of treasure hunters called Ocean X. And Peter Lindbergh, the captain, again, was very excited about what they found. It is now said that there have been samples taken from the area. This area, again, 91 meters below the surface of the water. Anything electric out there, and the satellite phone as well, stopped working, Lindbergh and his team reported, when we were above the object. And then when we got away, about 200 meters away, it turned on again. And when we got back over the object, once again, some of our equipment stopped working. Now, about these samples recovered by divers, they were given to a geologist. Steve Weiner was his name. Stop snickering. And he ruled out the possibility of it being a natural geological formation. And after examining the fragments, he claimed that the materials were, quote, metals which nature could not reproduce itself. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about what this thing might have been. Some experts have suggested it's a Nazi anti-submarine device. Some have said it might be a gun turret from a former battleship. Others believe it is, well, a UFO. And some even have gone so far as to call it the Roswell of the ocean. But there's still no evidence, really, that suggests that the UFO-like object is an alien ship. Now, there's Volker Brucher, an associate professor of geology at Stockholm University. And he's apparently reported that his hypothesis is that the object, this structure, was formed during the Ice Age many thousands of years ago. And he thinks that it is, contrary to what geologists have said, probably a naturally formed object. We really don't know. But it is interesting, if nothing else, that 5 years after the fact, we still don't really have a conclusive opinion about what may be out there under the Baltic Sea. Interesting stuff, isn't it? Speaking of aliens, you know, from time to time there are individuals who walk this earth that are so talented, so remarkable in their prowess, musical, artistic, and otherwise, they might just very well qualify for being aliens themselves. We'll remember one of those here on this program. When we return, it is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Glad to be with you guys, as always. Follow me on Twitter, at Micah Hanks. You can tweet at me during the program. You can also check out the KGRA.com/chatroom page where we, well, as the name entails, we actually have a chat room set up right there. So this has been a bad year, unfortunately, as far as good musicians gone home to rest. Yep. We lost David Bowie, of course, Merle Haggard, only recently, and the most recent of the losses, of course, Prince. That's right, he was defined as a genre-bending rocker. And of course, he passed away at the age of 57. In addition to being a musical pioneer, this Minneapolis native, I spent a lot of time up in Minnehaha myself, and I tell you, it's a wonderful area. And he had been very, very dedicated to the preservation of the music there in his area. He will be, as much as Bowie or Haggard or anyone else that we have lost, Prince will certainly be missed. You know, a few things about him. I actually find him to be a compelling and interesting person, apart from the music that he produced. You know, Prince was only about 5'2" tall. He was a pretty short little guy. Some described him as fairy-like, and not in a bad way. I mean, he was very small, but he had a very commanding, almost magical presence. He was remarkably intelligent, and if you ever watched interviews with him, you know, he was so eloquent in the way that he spoke. He was a notoriously well-dressed individual and a person with a certain pizzazz and a kind of fashion sense that was really unparalleled. Those who knew him, even Donald Trump, has talked about what a great guy Prince was. Here's a little-known fact, by the way. Prince, he wrote a lot of songs for people that were recorded by other artists over the years, and one of those songs, I believe it was actually called Donald Trump Black Version. It was written in 1990 and performed by a rhythm and blues funk group called The Time. The song was written by Prince. He actually wrote a song that was loosely based on Donald Trump. Prince did. It's kind of interesting. But there are a number of other interesting things about Prince, and here in a moment I want to go into some of his very unique beliefs as they relate to the kind of thing we discuss on this program. But, you know, his name really was Prince. That wasn't just a pseudonym that he adopted. He was actually born on June 7th, 1958, as Prince Rogers Nelson. And he was named after his father's jazz combo that he had at the time. It is pretty well known that he was a Jehovah's Witness. He wrote a lot of songs, as I mentioned earlier, for other artists. His symbol that he used actually had a name, apparently. Even though the whole world referred to him as either the artist or the artist formerly known as Prince, that weird symbol he used, he even had a guitar shaped like that, you remember? That symbol was actually called Love Symbol Number 2. And he copyrighted it in 1997, but when Prince's contract with Warner Brothers expired at midnight on December 31st, 1999, he announced that he was reclaiming his given name and went back to being called Prince. But yeah, there for a while, he took Love Symbol Number 2 and just went by that. You know, in 1987, his half-sister, Lorna Nelson, had sued him, claiming that she had written the lyrics to the song You Got the Look. Yeah, he was sued by his sister. Apparently also in 1984, speaking of people he ticked off, after purchasing the Purple Rain soundtrack for her then-11-year-old daughter, Tipper Gore, ex-wife of former Vice President Al Gore, became enraged over the explicit lyrics of that song, Darling Nikki, a song that references, well, masturbation and other graphic sex acts. Now, Gore felt that there should be some sort of warning. You'll remember this. This is one of the most contentious debates in the world of music, probably that's come along in the last several decades. Yeah, he decided that there needed to be a warning label on such recordings, and in 1985 formed the Parents Music Resource Center, which pressured the recording industry to adopt a rating system similar to the one employed in Hollywood. Of course, to Prince's credit, he didn't oppose the label system and became one of the first artists to release a quote-unquote clean version of his explicit albums. Apparently in 2006, Universal decided to do a promotional stunt in which 14 purple tickets were hidden, 7 in the U.S. and 7 internationally, inside of Prince's latest album, which at that time was 3121. Fans who found a purple ticket were invited, Willy Wonka style, to attend a private performance at Prince's Los Angeles home. Apparently on the week of July 27th in 1984, this is also cool, Prince's first, or his film Purple Rain, which was also a song, which was based, of course, on his longtime girlfriend, who interestingly, Vanity, I believe was her name, she interestingly passed away this year just as well, at the same age, 57, that Prince passed away. Now, apparently when the film Purple Rain hit number one at the box office, that same week the film's soundtrack was the best-selling album, and when Doves Cry was holding the top spot for singles, so he simultaneously held the number one spots for all of the following, film, single, and album. Now, apparently during Prince's first appearance on Saturday Night Live, he performed the song Party Up and sang the lyric, "Fighting the war is such a blanking bore." Well, it went unnoticed at that time, they say, but in the closing segment, Charles Rocket, who had been on the program that night, apparently said, "I'd like to know who the blank did it." This was the only episode of SNL where the F-bomb was actually dropped on two occasions. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Now, there was also an instance where, rather than actually claiming the top spot, Prince was said to have actually killed an album release after a spiritual epiphany that he had. This was 1987. He was due to release what was called the Black Album. And mere days before it was scheduled to drop, Prince scrapped the entire thing. He called it Dark and Immortal. The musician claimed to have reached this decision following a spiritual epiphany that he had. Some reports say that it was actually an early experience with drug ecstasy, while others suggested that the artist just knew it would flop and decided to withdraw the entire thing. Who knows exactly what the actual case may have been. But you know, when we talk about the interesting things in Prince's life, apart from the music and the career trivia, and this is what I really find interesting. Prince had said throughout his life he'd had a number of really interesting experiences. Among these experiences, he had talked about early in his life that he had no actual recollection of what he describes here, but that his mother told him that when he was a child, he was actually born with epilepsy, and that there was a sort of miraculous healing which occurred. In his own words, talking in 2009 to talk host Tavis Smiley, this is how Prince described his miraculous healing at an early age.
I've never spoken about this before, but I was born epileptic. And I used to have seizures when I was young. And my mother and father didn't know what to do or how to handle it, but they did the best they could with what little they had. And my mother told me one day, I walked into her and said, Mom, I'm not going to be sick anymore. And she said, why? And I said, because an angel told me so. Now, I don't remember saying it. That's just what she told me. And from that point on, I've been having to deal with a lot of things, getting teased a lot in school. And, you know, early in my career, I tried to compensate for that by being as flashy as I could and as noisy as I could. And, you know, I just looked, again, I look forward to this time in my life when I could reflect back on it and talk to people like yourself, Dr. Cornell West. I mean, when you all come over to the house and we sit and we just talk about heavy things, I just become thankful. I don't know.
I really appreciate his outlook on life. You know, Prince had a wonderful way of seeing things. He would often talk about, you know, bringing people over to the house. He was known to be seen riding his bike around his neighborhood there in Minneapolis. People said he was very much a man of the community, despite having a notoriously private lifestyle. He liked to keep to himself. And, of course, you know, some in the community probably had found some of his opinions on things a little strange. For instance, Prince had long believed that since his childhood he had observed a phenomenon today popularly known as chemtrails. During the same interview with Tavis Smiley, he described this just as well.
When I saw the State of the Black Union, Dick Gregory really moved me and a lot of my friends. I show it to everybody that comes over the house, especially white folks, because they need to hear that, you know, so that they know more about all of us. Mm-hmm. Because what he said affects all of us. He said something that really hit home about this phenomena of chemtrails. And, you know, when I was a kid, I used to see these trails in the sky all the time and say, oh, that's cool. A jet just went over. And then you started to see a whole bunch of them. And the next thing you know, everybody in your neighborhood was fighting and arguing and you didn't know why. Okay? And you really didn't know why. I mean, everybody was fighting. So he started riffing about the chemtrails. And he started to say things that hit home so hard. And I would recommend that everybody try to get what he said online or wherever and try to get a copy of it and just listen to it. Because I was so moved that I had to write the song.
So that's interesting that Prince had been moved to write a song in part by conspiracy theories involving chemtrails. Now, you know, I'm not one who really buys into that, although there have been some interesting pieces of footage that have appeared online, and of course some accompanying literature. The long-held conspiracy theory that apart from just jet contrails, that there are what are referred to as chemtrails, some of which apparently introduce into the atmosphere chemical agents which may modify human behavior, as Prince described right there. And I found that to be a very interesting segment because as he's sitting there and Tavis is listening to him, I wasn't sure exactly what Tavis's reaction was, if he was listening and was spellbound or was startled by the fact that, you know, one renowned and talented, truly gifted, I think, as Prince had been, would bring up a subject like that and talk about it. on a program along those lines. I've got one more soundbite about some of the esoteric interests of Prince, and this one has to do with not only lucid dreaming, but his belief that he had been visited prior to his own death by the late David Bowie in a dream. It's not Prince himself talking about it, but a friend of his. And this gentleman online, I believe, operates under the name, he's got a funny sort of a nickname. Jeremiah Freed is his real name, but he goes by Dr. Funkenberry. And he had appeared on one of the talk shows talking about Prince describing lucid dreams.
Jeremiah, I know you, I've known him for a long time. You had a chance to speak to him earlier this year, specifically about his dreams, which is something that really stood out to me. What did he tell you about them?
He actually said this when he was on stage doing he kicked off his piano and a microphone tour at Paisley Park in January. And during the performance, when he mentioned David Bowie's passing, he also mentioned that he has lucid dreams a lot. And then he sees friends that have passed away in these dreams, and he's able to conversate with them, and he looks forward to these dreams. It's kind of weird, and this was before like his longtime girlfriend, Vanity, passed away. This is before that even, so it just was a little eerie, you know. But for him, it probably makes sense. It made him happy that he's able to see people that he isn't normally able to see, but only in these dreams.
And you describe it as a little bit eerie, but when you hear the details of what happened, no signs of trauma, no reason to believe it was a suicide, so sudden, sure, he indicated he wasn't feeling well, but so sudden. How do you make sense of it?
It's hard to make sense, especially because of how private he is, and I'm sure he wouldn't be happy with everything that's going on. You know, he doesn't want to be mourned. He'd rather have his music and his life and everything just celebrated. You know, just this whole privacy thing, and then all this, he wouldn't want what's going on and what's going to be going down in a few weeks. And we just need to, at least for the best, what he would want is just to celebrate the music, celebrate everything, celebrate the life. Let's not mourn.
All right, Jeremiah, thank you very much.
This is something I often say when it comes to the necessary part of life we all must experience, which is, of course, the passing of those whom we know. I hope we can all respect the memory and the privacy of Prince, and also appreciate his contributions musically. And in closing out this segment, remembering that marvelous talent that he was, again, he was this man of fairly small stature, very, very eloquent and modest, I think, in the way he carried himself, except for when he was really on stage and really into it. But I remember when I was a child, and he was doing a concert with the famous Love Symbol No. 2 guitar. And I knew that he was a good singer and a writer of very soulful music. I'd never seen him play guitar at that point. And he starts a solo in the middle of one of his songs. Now, when I was a kid growing up, loved Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix was the guy to me. And he and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Jimmy Page were probably my all-time three favorites growing up, although Eddie Van Halen came in there also. And really, none of those in any particular order. All the guitar greats. And yes, as many listeners know, a lot of the music you hear featured on this program, I actually perform on a guitar as well. My guitar of choice growing up was always a Stratocaster. These days I play a Gibson Les Paul Custom. I've always kind of had an affinity for the Telecaster, though, which is the guitar that Prince played when he wasn't doing the Love Symbol No. 2 guitar. But he took that break, and I remember thinking it reminded me so much of, like, Hendrix, who probably was on acid, and yet it sounded like Hendrix on acid, okay? That's how good Prince was on that guitar. It was just remarkable. And I'll never forget, and when I found out about Prince's passing the other day, I actually linked this on Facebook. During the Rock and Roll Hall induction, or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony a couple of years ago, Tom Petty and George Harrison's son, they were all up there and they were doing the song While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And they get through the song, and at the end where, again, on the original Beatles recording, all the guys, John and Paul and George, they were just rocking out. And it's one of the best Beatles cuts to me. It's just got some great jamming guitar on it. But right there at the end, out of nowhere on the stage, Prince appears. He's got this hat on, and he is just dressed to the nines, and he's rocking that classic Telecaster. He pulls out every stop. If you go online and you find that video, you want to see what good guitar playing looks like, you owe it to yourself to find that. Prince was one of the most remarkably talented musicians that you've ever seen. Singer, collaborator, songwriter, I mean, he had so many talents, but let me tell you something. The guy knew how to bring the rock on the guitar and often did. And I think that truly that single performance on stage with Tom Petty and George Harrison's son and Jeff Lynne as he's rocking that Telecaster, it is probably, in my opinion, one of the all-time greatest live guitar solos ever captured on tape or film. And that was Prince. Truly incredible stuff. He will be missed and he will be remembered. When we come back, we'll pick up on a little bit more news before we go to some messages from those of you out there when we return in the next hour on the Graylin Report. Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylin Report. We've got a short segment here before we come back at the top of the hour. I think we've got just enough time to get to this story reported by GeekWire this week, which some are observing as being possibly the first successful gene therapy that has ever been implied against human aging. But what's interesting about this is that not only are some saying that for the first time data may show that a human being has been successfully rejuvenated by gene therapy, but apparently this was done outside of your typical experimental structure. This was an individual. As a matter of fact, actually, it was the founder of the BioViva USA company, Elizabeth Parrish. She traveled to another country and actually conducted experiments on herself because she believes that this is something that needs to be done and that it may be able to help others on down the road. A bit of background, then we've got some audio. Last fall, the 45-year-old Seattle woman underwent an experimental type of gene therapy aimed at addressing some of the big effects of aging, including loss of muscle mass and also of shortening of the chromosome's telomeres. Now, this procedure was reportedly carried out in Colombia in order to be able to get around U.S. regulations on such experimental testing. The idea of having gene therapy done on yourself, of course, has raised eyebrows in the biotech community. But Parrish says, "I 100% believe that it will work, or else I would have not done it." She said, "I didn't try to flame out in glory. The research shows that it absolutely does work." Now, she was interviewed by GeekWire about this recently. Again, it is a controversial study, but what she says, she stands behind, of course, and she believes this will help people in the future who suffer from various debilitating diseases and, of course, may help eventually ward off the effects of aging as we know it.
The formation of BioViva as a company was to give patients access to genetic therapies, to potential genetic cures. I wouldn't want to give a therapy to someone else that I hadn't taken. If I believe in it, I should take it.
Give us a sense of what you see in the future if this works.
You know, what we're trying to do is make you young all the way through, because aging affects the brain, it affects all of the organs. But definitely, if you don't look younger, then we failed, because your skin is one of the biggest organs in your body. So we don't want it to fail either. So that is probably one of the great eureka moments that people have when they say, "Wow, I'll look younger too." This is something that the whole world should be involved in. You know, I'm so happy to be sitting down with you, and I'm happy with all the interviews we've done, but I don't know why everyone in the world doesn't know about this.
And this is exactly why you've decided to take this risk with your own health and your own life, for that very reason.
Well, you know, when it really came down to it, I believe in the therapeutics. I believe in the research that's been done behind them. I believe in my team. I believe in the very premise of what we began. And by taking these, I can potentially speed up that time frame. for everyone.
Where do you see yourself in that that line of time? Are you like 2 years ahead, 5 years ahead? How far out did you plant that flag in terms of time? What is it going to take for the rest of the world to catch up to you?
I think that we're probably about 15 or 20 years ahead in the sense of running up any company who's doing the regular U.S. FDA sort of model. Yeah, I'm really motivated. I see like a future that is just so much better than what we have now, you know, that we are getting better. We're getting smarter. Let me phrase a question. If you could do one thing in your life that could save 1 million lives and maybe 1 billion, would you do it? I would.
Now, you can tell, of course, she's quite passionate about what she's doing here. I mean, again, carrying out an experimental procedure on herself with the hope of eventually saving lives and perhaps also warding off the effects of aging. Now, she believes that she and her company are about 20 years ahead of the current science on the, well, again, the subject of anti-aging. Are we really headed toward a future in which we can, well, take our aging, our lifespan into our own hands through the lens of technology? Is that playing God or is that improving lives? info@micahhanks.com. I'd love to hear from you about that. A little more information before we go to the break. The gene therapy that Parrish underwent was aimed at inhibiting myostatin and building up telomeres. Now, earlier this year, she was reluctant to describe the effect. She said, there are a lot of things I could say, oh, you know, this or that happened, but it could all have been due to the placebo effect. Data is king. So only recently, a lot more data has really come forward. Apparently, the Biogerontology Research Foundation reported that Parrish's telomeres were short for her age, and when her white blood cells were tested last September at Spectra Cell Laboratories in Houston, they said that Spectra Cell ran the same test in March and that telomere length had gone from 6,710 DNA base pairs to 7,330 base pairs, which again does seem to represent the data which she has hoped to present. The foundation said further that the lengthening implied that Parrish's white blood cells had become biologically younger. Now, that's debatable according to some, but for one thing, the findings haven't yet been submitted for peer-reviewed publication. Of course, no real test has been done apart from that which she left the country to perform on herself. And then finally, the connection between a change in telomere length and improved cellular function hasn't been nailed down either. Human telomere length can vary pretty widely from less than 5,000 to more than 15,000 base pairs, so we don't know exactly what we are dealing with yet. But maybe, indeed, there is hope on the horizon for those who suffer from various debilitating diseases, and maybe even new advances in anti-aging. But the question once again remains, some will ask, is what BioViva has done and what Parrish herself did, is that ethical? Is that good science? And really, is circumventing good science for the greater good in this case? I guess only time will tell. We'll be back shortly here on the Grayling Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping it company as always, Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. And of course, if you are one of the listeners, the many who download this program after the fact online, anywhere, anytime, worldwide, around the globe, on the internet, it is the Grayling Report. And I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Glad to be here with you as always. This new audio interface, I tell you, if things sound as good going out to you guys out there as they do right here in my earpiece, oh yeah, baby. It's going to be even sexier than you already know and recognize with this program. I'm not just talking about me. Enough about me. How about you, all you sexy things out there in the audience? Yeah, you know who you are. Yeah, listening to the Graylian Report is sexy. Tell your friends. Be sure to let them know that if they get online, they can download this program via iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Live, every Monday night on KGRIRadio.com. Lots of ways to listen. Lots of ways to contribute. You can also become one of us. In the tradition of the Evil Dead, join us. Come on down to the bunker. Sign up for Graylian X. It's graylianreport.com/X. Become a subscriber. Support what we do. Get additional weekly shows, monthly specials, and much more. That's right. We have more fun, probably, than people in a pre-AI domineering planet should be able or allowed to have. But until our cyborgic overlords eventually overtake us, we're going to keep on having as much fun as we can, like we do every week. Glad to be here with you, as always. You know, now I'm going to go ahead and get to the listener emails. I've got some stories, though. I really, really, really am anxious to get to these. Two stories that have to do with this idea of, well, two things that are I find to be quite similar to one another. One is the universe of simulation. We've talked about that quite a bit on this show before. What might surprise you is who has become the latest advocate of the idea. And then a little later in the program also, I wonder, has evolution kept us from really being able to see reality? Or perhaps we would ask, is the reality that we see one that we have evolved to see? And if we can recognize that our perception of reality is based on how we have evolved, then, well, what is the real reality? Is there such a thing as a real reality? And what within the reality that we perceive might be hidden from us as a result of the way our minds and bodies have evolved to interact with our environment? Questions that we will address a bit later. First, I want to address the addresses that have been sent along. Well, I guess messages from various web addresses. You know what I mean. Listen to emails. John, we'll start with you. John, actually, from Cumbria. I want to give you a quick shout-out. This is a good guy. He is one of our contributors, part of the family, that is comprised, of course, by Mark Brady and Jan in Ireland, my dear friend Lindsay. John's one of them. And, of course, also, I think, really, the earliest, gosh, yeah, I think going all the way back, the other John, we've had a lot of contributors over the years. Gary, who likes to remain hidden, so I can't give out too much information. Yeah. I like to try and protect the identities of the innocent, especially those who are crazy enough to be able to, on a daily basis almost, send me news stories for the roundups we feature at graylianreport.com. So John, one of them, writes, "Morning, Mike. I hope you enjoyed your birthday yesterday and recovering from a Guinness-induced hangover." Yes. Yes. Although it was a couple of weeks ago, I think I've gotten over it. He said, "I found last week's Graylian Report to be an excellent show, coming as you were from the road, and I especially enjoyed listening to your account of talking to the gentleman in the bar who was telling you of an account of his story of serving in Afghanistan and running into something that was killing soldiers." Okay, brief recap. From the segment that we did live from the road, Cam, Kyle, and I, on our way passing through Oklahoma and Texas, there was a story when we were at the historic Basin Hotel that was told to me by Drew, the bartender there. It was funny because I went up there. Again, you know, I dressed like a man not of his own time. And so I guess I was a bit of a spectacle. I wasn't really all that crazily dressed, but, you know, we were going to dinner to meet with some fans, Emma and Brian and Cam and Kyle and I. And so I wore my long black coat. I brought that specifically because I knew it was going to be colder up there in Eureka Springs, and it was. They even had the heater on out there on the balcony where we were. So I had my long black coat, which comes down to about mid-thigh length. Bought it in London with the lovely lady Beth. And as I go over to the bar, the fella says, "Oh, you must be in town for this UFO conference." And immediately, Drew, the bartender, just starts conversing with me. And as I'm talking with him, I told this story on the show. I ordered a scotch, and he passes it across the bar to me. I mean, it was like something out of a Western film. He says, "First one's on me, buddy." And he had a story to tell. And the story he told, as we described on that episode of the show, was about a friend of his who came in and sat there getting snockered at the bar one night. And finally, he acted all night like he had something he had to get off his chest. And he said, "Look, you know, while I was over there in Afghanistan, there was something up there in the mountains that was killing our soldiers." And he said that eventually it was killed, and they had to haul the thing out on a flatbed. It was some great big creature. Now, that, you know, make of it what you will. This was the story that this guy told. I'm passing along the story. You know, it's probably folklore in likelihood. And John writes, "That story sounded very similar to an episode of the podcast known as the Sasquatch Chronicles. Now, I'll make a note about that here in a moment, but let's first hear what John said. He said, I listened to it a few months back when Wes, the host, had a researcher on called Duke, who was talking about what were called mountain giants, a particular type of Bigfoot which he was sure existed, he said. And he played a clip from Coast to Coast from 2009 where the researcher known as Steve Quayle brought on to Coast a serving soldier with him who wished to remain anonymous, but who talked to George Norrie about a mission which involved flying a giant back to the U.S. after special forces had killed this creature, as it, again, was killing U.S. servicemen. Now, John says, I wonder if this incident, if true, was connected in any way to the tale you were told by your friend in the bar that night. Anyway, your thoughts would be appreciated. Your friend, John in Cumbria. Thank you again, John, for writing. Thank you for the news links you send along. Anybody who'd like to do that, info@micahanks.com, info@graylianreport.com. They both come to the same place. You're welcome to send along stories. But as far as this story goes, that is an interesting one. Now, the Sasquatch Chronicles podcast, you know, for a time, my good friend Shannon LeGros, who's been on this show, I've been on her new program, Into the Fray, she participated in that show for a while. The long story, severely shortened, when Shannon and I became friends, I was invited on that show. And we did a segment in which I was discussing a kind of a skeptical interpretation of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, which is probably not something that is typically featured on that show. For whatever reason, Wes chose not to air it. And I remember Shannon kind of coming to me and saying, you know, I really apologize. Apparently, Wes feels like we waited too long to air that and we can't use that episode. Now, that it was in no way, shape, or form Shannon's fault, by the way. And whatever the actual reason had been that was not aired, it was only about a week later when I saw that Shannon had resigned from the program. And what had happened was after appearing on Coast to Coast and telling a story of being surrounded by Sasquatches someplace in Washington State, I believe, Wes and his brother, and the story that they told was called seriously into question. So Shannon did what the other hosts soon would do as well. She left the program, and I have always respected her for doing that. You know, and I'm very glad for people like Shannon who stand for the moral principles of what good researchers, no matter where you stand or what you believe in this community, what we all hope to try and do, which is to bring a serious discussion about these subjects to the table, and to bring it honestly and with integrity. You know, and I don't know Wes. I mean, you know, he may be a great guy. I just know that there were people who were questioning severely the veracity of the story that he told. Now, that said, many people also have their opinions about Steve Quayle. I've heard him. He's quite the character. And frankly, actually, they've linked to some of my articles on their website. I would guess that I have a very different opinion about some of the ancient mysteries and the giant skeleton reports and things like that. Taking the skeptical disposition that I do, my opinions would probably differ from those of Steve. But by the same token, again, the story was that Steve had brought someone on to Coast, a serviceman who had said that they had some sort of an incident with some creature, a giant, as they called it, that was killing servicemen. To me, the entire story that was told to me in Eureka Springs reminded me a little bit of the Tremors movies. And when we were in the car on the way back from the conference, Kyle actually pointed that out as we were doing the podcast from the road. And I wonder sometimes if, you know, films, horror movies, and things like that don't actually serve more as the basis for some of these stories than actual fact. But it is a compelling idea, at very least, to presume that maybe there was something over there, and maybe from time to time there are stories that people tell that involve weird things that people encounter in wartime. You know, Mac Maloney wrote a book about that, UFOs in Wartime. Ken Hudnall, a guy who interviewed me a number of years ago, actually talked about being in Vietnam, and he said that they were firing at something that they thought was an enemy encampment, and the thing took off straight up into the air out of the Vietnamese jungle. And he said, okay, what the heck, you know, what was that? And that, of course, led to his interest in UFOs. Who knows? Keith writes, Micah, I need advice from my favorite and all-knowing podcaster. I have a friend who, for a while now, has claimed to be a reptilian from a star system that he calls Miran D. He's gone as far a couple of times as to eat an insect. All this time I've been neutral and non-confrontational on this subject, playing along, as you might say. Do you think I should keep playing along, or get him to start questioning his claims? A loyal listener, love your show, Keith. Appreciate you writing in, by the way, Keith. I think Keith's written a few times, and so often I have so many emails. These days, it's really getting out of hand, so if I don't get to your messages on this show, people, you know, my apologies. I get to the ones that I can. Keith, my advice to you, I doubt your friend's a reptilian. I mean, for all we know, he may be. You never know. Has anyone, by the way, seen the new, I don't know if it's new, but the Weird Al Yankovic video? I'm not even sure what it's called. I linked it on Facebook, though. He's talking about tinfoil and the wonders of tinfoil. And Patton Oswalt, who just lost his wife, keep him in your prayers and thoughts, please. Patton Oswalt's in the video with him, and halfway through it just goes full-blown Illuminati conspiracy. And if you haven't seen it, I won't tell you exactly what happens, but it ties in with the reptilian thing right there at the end. So, Keith, you know, unless your friend can pull his face off and reveal his reptilian interior, I would seriously question his claims. I certainly would. But by the same token, some people, you know, they're going to say strange things, and maybe they're entitled to have their belief. You know, it's really up to you. But my personal opinion, Keith, if anything, is that no, your friend probably is not a reptilian from a distant star system. And unless he really enjoys eating insects, I don't think that eating insects really is very good proof of his reptilian heritage either. But I do appreciate you writing, Keith. Joey writes also, Mike, I'm just catching the 4/18/16 show via podcast. You posed the question, is it a violin or is it a fiddle? Well, good sir, that all depends on whether you're wearing shoes while you play. With shoes, it's a violin, and without, it's a fiddle. Yours truly from Eastern Tennessee, the other side of the mountain, Joey. Oh, but what was it that I said on the show? Yeah, when Einstein says it's a fiddle, you know, I'll err to his judgment. And I think here regionally, we tend to call it that anyway. Michael writes, as a Texan and a fan of your great podcasts, I'm a big fan of Expanded Perspectives as well. So am I. He says, something you might find interesting happened to me last night. I recently listened to an episode you made where you discussed your trip to York, England. Now, other than growing up in London as a kid and being totally terrified on a ghost tour in York by a puppet that the tour used to jump out at tourists for a cheap scare, I thought that you had to say what you had to say about synchronicity was very interesting. He says, you discussed how you had a deja vu experience, if I'm remembering correctly, and then tried the thought experiment of seeing a blue rose later that day, which you ended up seeing in a local pub. That is correct, Michael, and the experiment actually took place, just to give a little bit of background on that, as I was walking through York with Mike Cleland, the researcher who wrote the great new book on owls and UFOs. I'm walking with Mike and his girlfriend Andrea, and we are passing through York, and I'm talking about Thomas Baker, the fourth doctor. You know, the guy who said, you know, I really think you might. And as we pass around the corner, there is a bakery called Thomas the Baker. And Andrea was like, oh my God. And I said, you see that, Andrea? And I said, Mike, you watch, because we're going to see a blue rose somewhere today. Because the blue rose, for whatever reason, holds certain synchronistic significance to me. For more on that, I do recommend watching the film Fire Walk With Me, the prequel to the well-received and well-known David Lynch series Twin Peaks, which also deals with owls, interestingly. I mean, this could spiral out of pure synchronistic control. But coming back to the point, Michael says, well, my friend, I had a moment 2 days ago where we both said the same thing, my friend and I, at the same time. And I said, let's try something and both be on the lookout for a blue rose tomorrow. He said, I'm not very creative, but that's okay. I don't mind you borrowing the blue rose. In fact, I encourage it. I'd like to see who else sees these things. Well, that next day, I was at a concert, and I look over, and the guy standing next to me had a blue rose tattoo on his arm, and it made me think how interesting our subconscious is. And while I don't think this was maybe psychic phenomena, it does seem you found a very good way to show how our minds work. Sincerely, Michael. Yeah, but it almost opens more questions than answers, does it? I'm reminded of that scene, you know, where Kiefer Sutherland is riding in the car, and he looks over at Chris Isaac in the film Fire Walk With Me, and he says, what did the blue rose mean? And Chris Isaac looks back at him and says, now that I can't tell you. Of course, the blue rose signifies mystery, and this is in part because blue roses don't occur naturally in nature. Jermon writes, hi, Micah. So I've been listening to the Grailian Report for a long time now, and I just started listening to Middle Theory, which I love. I wanted to let you know that I love the music you play on the Grailian Report in between segments. But there is one that sounds familiar to me, and I was hoping if you knew it as well. It's an 8-bit music sound, which I absolutely love, and it brings back my childhood memories, which is also why I love dubstep. But he says, I'm listening, and I couldn't figure it out, and one day I decided to listen to the soundtrack for Jurassic Park for the Super Nintendo. You remember the game. Lots of rage quitting. Well, that led me to a walkthrough for the game, and in turn, a YouTube link suggested a walkthrough video of Jurassic Park for the original Nintendo game, the NES version, and I'm watching it and hear a very familiar melody playing. The main theme song of the game is in your bumper music. I guess you're a Jurassic Park freak like I am, and I'm so thrilled now because I'm going to download the 8-bit music from the game and make it my ringtone. I've been trying to figure it out. I knew I'd heard it before. Talk about synchronicity. Love the shows and take care. Jermon from New York City. I'm glad you figured that out, by the way. That was a techno remix that Caleb did of the, an 8-bit version of a song that appeared in a Jurassic Park video game. That is kind of funny, isn't it? Where these songs actually come from. I wonder if I've actually got it right here. Let's see. I probably do. So this is the song we're talking about. Anyway, that gives you an idea. That's the one they're talking about. Thank Caleb Hanks for that little remix. Lots of fun stuff. Caleb's also really good with his original compositions. Okay, now this is probably one of the emails I've looked forward to the most this week. I'm a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks behind on some of these messages. And just last night, my good buddy Dan James, a companion in space and time who I've actually visited with while I was in California. I know he's a friend of the Fair Lady Claire in Ireland. Dan wrote last night, after I appeared on Beyond the Strange, and he said, I've got a time slip story for you, and I'm going to try and send it to you. And he did get it to us just in time for the broadcast tonight. I know he's out there listening, so thanks, Dan. And the story goes like this. So a few years ago, a good friend of mine, and chef by occupation, was called to a historic mansion on the outskirts of Melbourne to fill for a few days. My friend, let's call him Michael, arrived promptly at the allotted time, found some helpful staff who pointed him up some stairs to a room where he could change into his uniform. Well, Michael made his way up and through a door at the top of the stairs to a small entrance room with one other door, and upon entering the next door was greeted in a hallway. There were rooms to either side all the way down. He opened the first door to his left, a bedroom, and proceeded to change, noting to himself what a magnificent job in the hotel they had done on restoring the Victorian mansion to its former glory, right down to the wallpaper finishes. Even the bed linen on the bed he sat down on was period perfect. The carpet, the patina on the wooden furniture, curtains, everything was very well reconstructed. Well, once he changed and his belongings were gathered, he set out into the hallway, nodding politely at the housekeeping staff and smiling at her period dress and trolley, again most impressive with its detail. Heading downstairs, Michael set about finding the kitchen and introduced himself to the staff and got acquainted with the evening's work ahead, all the while commenting to the rest of the staff what a great job management had done with restoring the wing at the top of the stairs. Well, it was at this point that Michael noticed a few sideways glances and smiles between his co-workers, but thought little of it being the new guy and got on with the evening. At the end of the night, chatting to the manager about the hotel, he mentioned the impressive restoration work. And the manager looked at him and asked where he meant, and then gave a bit of a laugh and took Michael back up the stairs and through that very same door. Now, at this point, Michael remembered that walking up the stairs had felt very different. As to the first time, nothing he could really accurately put his finger on. It was just different. But the other side of the door was indeed the second door, which, to Michael's surprise, was now boarded up. Well, he explained he had witnessed earlier in the evening. The manager assured him it was impossible and took him around to another entrance where he was able to see into the wing, which had been completely gutted and was now ready for restoration. There was nothing of the beautifully restored rooms, just half walls and strewn building materials. Now, call it what you will, but knowing Michael well, he wouldn't create such a story just to have a story to tell, and from my mind, a very credible witness he was to a strange phenomena. Call it a time slip, alternate dimension, whatever you will, it was an experience that will stay with him forever. Now, Dan attached a picture of the mansion in question to give a feel for the environment in which the story had its origins, and I gotta tell you, you look at this picture. Yeah, it makes you really think about things like time travel. I hope this tale will, if nothing more, cause you to raise an eyebrow in interest. Regards, as always, my friend Dan James. And Dan, that's one of the good ones right there, I'll tell you. I love those time slip stories. Brennan Storr wrote in. I've actually had an opportunity to talk to him a little bit on the live paranormal report shows that Jim Harold and I do. He had a personal experience with one of those kind of things. And we're going to do another one of those live call-in shows via Blab tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern. If you're around, you're welcome to tune in, of course, and listen to that, or even call in and share your own stories. really interesting ones. Before we go to break, I do want to get to one more email from a friend of mine, Jason. And, you know, actually, no, we're going to go on to break because I want to extrapolate a little bit on what Jason has written. He brings some good points to the table as it relates to the subject of UFOs and how to study them, something I often talk about on this show, and we actually did a segment last week about that. So we'll go on to the break now. When we come back, we'll feature Jason Bradley's email. He's one of my good skeptic buddies out there who likes to play devil's advocate, which is something that is extremely necessary if we're going to make any headway with the phenomena we discuss. It is the Graylian Report, where much phenomena is often discussed. And we'll be back here again right after this. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Okay, I have to tell you, I like this. This is a tune that was sent along. I often tell you guys out there, if you're musicians, from time to time we feature new music from musicians in the audience. This one by Monkey Warhol. The song is Alien Syndrome. Check him out online, Monkey Warhol. He is on SoundCloud. You can also find him on YouTube. And I'm sure we'll feature some more of his music here on this program. Really good stuff. By the way, I think during the break there, I think that my new audio interface may have had an epileptic seizure of some sort. At least it sounded as though this occurred. I got a message in my chat window over here from Hobbs. Yeah. I'm not sure what that was, Race. It sounded like you were singing a song, though, there for a second.
I was like, wait a minute. Am I in the air?
Was that me? Maybe you actually experienced the time slip.
I think I did.
Yeah, you just fell through a window into another dimension, another reality.
Just another day with the doctor.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it tends to happen. A little later in the program, we're going to be talking about whether or not the reality that we know is what it actually appears to be. But first, I promised we'd get to Jason's email, who writes, "Hey, Micah, so I was listening to the episode about the UAP and the human side of science. And, of course, I had some thoughts. Now, I first want to bring about the 600-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to your attempt to organize the close encounter concept for UFOs. Now, Jason writes, there's a huge dividing line that we more skeptical types find glaring when it comes to reports of UFOs and other phenomena, and that is the difference between substantial evidence and anecdote. We've discussed the value of anecdotes. When Jason says we've discussed... he's somebody who's, like many of you out there in the audience, whose opinions on things I do value, and he tends to write to me and will privately discuss a lot of these kind of things because I find that, you know, engaging in dialogue with people who don't necessarily share all the same views that I have, it helps temper my own argument, and so he and I have gone back and forth rather prolifically at this point. I always joke that there are certain people that if we took all the emails that we've exchanged over the years, we'd have book-length manuscripts already written. I mean, it's going to be you and I, Jason. So he said, we've discussed the value of anecdotes before, and I know you understand the problem, but it seems to be a huge issue for the believer crowd to work through. In fact, recently I had an email exchange with one of the podcasters on a well-known podcast. I'm not going to name it here just because this is a private correspondence. They're great guys, and it's a good show, but the host in question hit some important alarms for me that he and I have discussed. One was that he has come to the conclusion that he doesn't really care about evidence. And I think that that's a massive mistake. I can understand why some people might not want to be interested, but how could you form a belief about something without examining evidence? To go along with this, he struggles with understanding how anecdotes, especially a lot of anecdotes, can't be taken seriously. I explain from my point of view, as evidence they have no real value, but it doesn't mean it can't be taken seriously, only that you have to understand the difference. My point being, I wish there was an annotation or something to indicate a report, like a UFO report, was anecdotal or without any other evidence. It would help someone like me, for example, sift through the cases that might be compelling and those which I wouldn't consider of interest. It most likely won't be important to a believer, especially with this new move toward trying to explain this phenomena through consciousness, which to me is unfortunate. Now, on that note, I'll just interject here that a lot of people, I think, say these days that really the key to understanding UFOs is to raise our awareness and to recognize that UFOs are not so much physical as they are some sort of a projection from within our own consciousness. You see. I don't mean to make fun of it, by the way. I mean, humor is a big part of what we try to do on this program because it makes things fun. And sometimes we can get so addled with our own seriousness that we don't have any fun. And if you're not having fun, why the hell would you do it, right? You know, I don't do this podcast to get stressed out every week, so we try to have a little fun. You know, and so for people who write to me and say things like, as one individual said recently, Micah, you've always been a clown, but now you're not even ashamed of it. Well, you know what? At least I'm an intelligent clown. And unlike you, I know how to smile. Why so serious? So that said, you know, when it comes to the question of consciousness, obviously this is a very important component in relation to how we relate to the universe and what we know and what we think we know. Epistemologically and otherwise, we have to ask the questions about consciousness. And as Red Pill Junkie has told me many times in our discussions, and other researchers have said the same, it may be among the greatest mysteries, if not the single most important question, as it relates to humans, of all time. But you see, it's still a question. Consciousness is not something which is a known quantity. Philosophers have wrestled with the question for centuries. Modern philosophers, physicists, neuroscientists, psychologists still wrestle with that question today. We don't understand all of the underpinnings of consciousness. It is as ever elusive as ever before. And as we try to reckon with the sense from within, which seems to signify what we recognize as the self, you know, we rely on this in order to be able to make our inquiries about other knowledge that we hope to attain in the world and in the reality around us, and yet we don't know exactly what the mode or the function of that consciousness is. It is a mystery, and therefore we cannot hope to explain other mysteries through the implication of another mystery. Two mysteries don't equal a problem solved. And hence, Bigfoot is a paranormal entity who is capable of traversing the ether or boundary between dimensions. I'm sorry, once again, to take another unquantifiable, unexplainable phenomena and to try and use that as the basis upon which another unexplainable can be explained, it doesn't work. It don't dice, okay? It don't make sense. So don't do it. That's my advice. And so as much as I'm interested in the potential connection between consciousness and UFOs, it is not an explanation for UFO phenomena. So I agree with Jason. He continues, you guys also discussed the idea that maybe abduction stories share some similarities between some of the other rash of paranormal claims, like, for instance, cult terror in the 70s and 80s. I've always maintained that something glaring about UFO phenomena is that it's always followed patterns. Saucers to cigars, cigars to triangles, triangles to lights, and so on. Now, I've always found this concept interesting, and I can't think of a moment when it's been addressed. To me, this is one of those situations that belies a possible cultural and meme-like experience. Ultimately, tracking those patterns may help us understand where the psychological component plays into this. Well, Jason, you know, and I've emailed him about this, but as we address it here on the program, I've talked about this numerous times on the show in the past, and I've written about it, I think, in the UFO Singularity just as well. To me, yeah, obviously there are, I don't know if I'd call them patterns. I would call them trends or noticeable changes that have occurred. Because I don't think that we could really just say, you know, discs to cigars, cigars. You know, really, torpedo-shaped and cigar-shaped, you know, i.e. the ghost rocket reports, predated the Kenneth Arnold reports of what were called flying saucers, but really weren't necessarily flying saucers. And throughout the decades, what's interesting is that whatever Kenneth Arnold actually saw, there have been reports of disc-shaped objects, but also spheres, egg-shaped, cylindrical objects, all different kinds of things. There is so much variety present in the literature surrounding UFO studies that, I mean, really it does become mind-boggling at times. And I think it certainly raises some questions. And more recently, the trend seems to have been, rather than, you know, a trend toward more and more abductions or more and more UFO sightings, actually, it seems that there appears to be an increase in technology that is proportionate to the decrease in UFO sightings and reports, especially those which imply occupant encounters, incidents where there is something or someone seen steering or operative in conjunction with a UFO sighting. So, you know, it's interesting that as the times change, some are saying UFO research is dying. Some are saying that the phenomena is disappearing. It's fading very slowly away. I know Richard Dolan, has gone on his show recently, not recently, about a year ago, and in response to a couple of articles that Nick Redfern and I had written about this, he had said, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. And in, you know, Rich's defense, although Nick and I have often said that in the broader sense of things, it does seem that the phenomena is maybe not trending differently, but changing. And yes, perhaps diminishing. You know, Rich, I think, would probably cite, look at the National UFO Reporting Center, look at MUFON. Obviously, there are still reports forthcoming. The problem is, as I would say, of those reports forthcoming, how many are reliable observations of truly exotic phenomena? Which is why I suppose that, I instituted, as we discussed last week, a new categorization system, and then more importantly, the filtration system for identifying various phenomena that might be mistaken for being unidentified flying objects. Jason also says, you know, I find increasingly the use of UAP instead of UFO interesting. I don't have an issue with it, really. I only have the question, I have to question the change in why it's being made. The few people I've heard weigh in tend to point to the negative effect UFO has on the topic, and in that case, I'm not sure it's necessary or useful. I was just discussing with a friend yesterday about the word handicap and how some social justice warriors are trying to get rid of the use of that word because it has negative connotations. Anyway, I'd love to hear your opinion on the topic and why you've chosen to go the UAP route. For me, it's pretty simple. As far as I know that UAP, I first saw it being used in the early 1990s in some of the British journals like New Ufologist. I know that some of the Ministry of Defense files that have been released utilize that term UAP as well. Best I can tell, there are two things. First of all, UAP is used both in Europe and in the United States as or being perceived as a more all-inclusive term. Rather than unidentified flying object, which seems to denote some physical structure or craft, UAP, unexplained aerial phenomena, which even Hillary Clinton cited when she was on Jimmy Kimmel Live, that appears to account for such things as natural phenomena as well, or things which may not, again, really quite qualify for being objects. I don't know that I would call a ball lightning-like manifestation or some other kind of apparently natural phenomena a object. I don't know that all quote-unquote unidentified aerial phenomena necessarily are objects. So UAP, I think, does in some sense work a little better. But I would also point out that in terms of differences between terminology applied in different regions and parts of the world, again, in the Spanish-speaking countries, it's OVNI, O-V-N-I. You know, UFO was instituted in 1953 by the U.S. Air Force. Well, maybe before that, but Edward Ruppelt around that time had instituted that acronym. And I see in equal measure that UAP was first really popularized in Britain. And I would guess that in addition to it being a more all-inclusive term, it was also as much a regional variant, much like OVNI is in the Latin American parts of the world. So I think that really kind of in a two-point structure addresses why some use UAP as opposed to just UFO. But it is interesting, and Jason certainly raises some interesting points. So, okay, that concludes the listener emails. Glad to be able to get that out of the way, and I think some meaningful commentary just as well. Before we go to break here, I want to go back to the news, because there has been something really interesting. I find this to be actually quite a significant turn of events. Tech Times reported over the weekend something that just, again, caused my jaw to drop. I'm just going to read a portion of this article for you, which will put everything, I think, in context for you, and it goes as follows. The entire universe we see around us may be nothing more than a simulation, this according to the famed astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson. This theory has been debated by astronomers and astrophysicists for decades, and now the host of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, states that the concept is in all probability the truth. Now, the Isaac Asimov Memorial Debate held at the Hayden Planetarium provided researchers with a forum for discussing unusual ideas about the universe, and it was here that Tyson made his pronouncement. He said, "What may have started as a science fiction speculation, that perhaps the universe as we know it is actually a computer simulation, has become a serious line of theoretical and experimental investigation among physicists, astrophysicists, and philosophers." Now, that's very interesting. This was reported by the American Museum of Natural History. The astronomer made the following argument in an effort to address the question. If the cosmos is infinite, and every possibility has occurred somewhere, if it is possible to simulate the universe in a matrix-type simulation, then one or more alien civilizations in an infinite universe have already, in likelihood, accomplished that feat, and therefore it stands to reason that we likely live within such a virtual reality. Which is a subject that, as a sort of a tangent, I brought up last night while I was talking with the fellows on Beyond the Strange. But it's really interesting to me because, skipping ahead into another portion of the article, it says, philosophers have spent centuries asking one question. How do we know reality is reality? The 17th century French philosopher René Descartes summed up his thoughts on the subject with the Latin phrase, cogito ergo sum, or I think, therefore I am. In short, he reasoned, the fact that the question is being asked requires a thought that exists in space and time. Tyson continues, and if that's the case, it is easy for me to imagine that everything in our lives is just the creation of some other eternity, or I'm sorry, some entity for their entertainment. I'm saying the day we learn that it is true, I will be the one in the room saying I'm not surprised. Now that is extremely interesting, and I'll tell you why. Because, again, Tyson being one among the crowd in the modern physics sphere that has been rather critical of philosophy is now coming around to a subject that the philosophers have been debating for an awful long time and saying that he believes it is likely. Philosophers and mathematicians have been talking about this for years. I remember there was a clip, and I referenced this when I gave a lecture in 2013 on singularity as it may relate to various UAP, and I actually talked about James Sylvester Gates Jr., and there's a great clip of him on a panel discussion talking about how within the lattice of the universe, there are mathematical realities that do seem to indicate functions very similar to computer coding. And I remember Neil Tyson was moderating the debate, and he says, wait a minute, hold on. So you mean to tell me that this entire universe might be a computer program? Or we're talking about some Matrix-type stuff. And he goes on, he's being a character, a showman. He's talking about how his mind is now blown by this. Well, I mean, yeah, many people have supposed that, well, it is at very least within an infinite universe a possibility that what we exist within is some sort of a matrix-like reality, some kind of a simulation. And I find it very interesting, as dismissive as Neil Tyson has been at times of philosophy, that he is now becoming a proponent of a philosophical reality, one which, sure, there is some empirical evidence to support, at least theoretically, but nonetheless one which seems to fall outside the purview of what is at present provable in our space-time reality. It's kind of funny, a little bit contradictory maybe even, and although he says, I'm going to be the one in the room saying I'm not surprised, I was quite surprised to find out that Neil Tyson, of all people, was the one standing in the room there at the Hayden Planetarium saying, yeah, maybe things aren't what they seem. I'd mentioned that, I have asked further that there is the question of how our own evolution may have affected, over time, our perception of reality. I do wonder sometimes how this may play into the discussion of things such as UAP or the UFO phenomena. And in Quantum Magazine actually carried an article on the evolutionary argument against reality. This may sound absurd to some, but really it's quite an interesting question that is asked. And in the magazine they ask, as we go about our daily lives, we tend to assume that our perceptions, our sights and sounds and textures and tastes, that they're an accurate portrayal of the real world. And sure, when we stop and we think about it, or when we find ourselves fooled by a perceptual illusion, we realize with a jolt that what we perceive is never the world directly, but rather our brain's best guess at what that world is like. In other words, when we're talking about simulated reality, it's kind of like an internal simulation of an external reality.
filtered through our own eyes and brains. And still, we bank on the fact that our simulation, whatever we perceive, is a reasonably decent one and an accurate one at that. Because if it wasn't, right, wouldn't evolution have weeded us out by now? We have evolved, we have survived, here we are. And the true reality might be forever beyond our reach, but surely our senses at least give us an inkling of what it's really like. Well, that may not be the case according to Donald D. Hoffman. This guy is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine. He's spent 3 decades now studying perception. He's also interested in artificial intelligence, as I am, and evolutionary game theory, as well as the brain, and his conclusion is pretty dramatic. This is what he's saying. The world presented to us by our perceptions is nothing like reality. And what's more, he says, we have evolution itself to thank for this magnificent illusion, as it maximizes evolutionary fitness by driving truth to extinction. Now, we've got a very small amount of time, so I'm just going to jump ahead. There is an interview in this article with Donald Hoffman. And the article reads, you know, getting at questions about the nature of reality and disentangling the observer from the observed is an endeavor that straddles the boundaries of neuroscience and fundamental physics. On one side, you'll find researchers scratching their chins, raw, trying to understand how a 3-pound lump of gray matter obeying nothing more than the ordinary laws of physics can give rise to first-person conscious experience. This is aptly named the hard problem, despite the fact that it deals with, you know, relatively soft gray matter within our cranium. But on the other side, we've got the quantum physicists, and they realize, of course, that, well, it's kind of hard, really, to define the location of objects localized in space until we really come along and observe them. The act of observation plays a key role in all this. And therefore, the central lesson of quantum physics is clear. There are no public objects sitting out there in some pre-existing space. John Wheeler, the physicist, put it like this: useful as it is under ordinary circumstances to say that the world exists out there independent of us, that view can no longer be upheld according to our observations of quantum physics. It is through the act of observation that apparently the reality unfolds. So, with the interview questions that they ask of Donald Hoffman, he was asked, how can seeing a false reality be beneficial to an organism's survival? He really brings to the table some unique perspectives on this. He says, there's a metaphor that's only been available to us in the past 30 or 40 years, and that's the desktop interface. Yeah, like on your computer, you know. He says, suppose there's a blue rectangular icon on the lower right corner of your computer's desktop. Does that mean that the file itself is blue and rectangular and lives in the lower right corner on your computer? Of course not. But those are the only things that can be asserted about anything on the desktop. It has color, position, and shape. Those are the only categories available to you, and yet none of them are true about the file itself or anything in the computer. That couldn't possibly be true. That's an interesting thing. You could not form a true description of the innards of the computer if your entire view of reality was confined to the desktop alone. And yet, the desktop is useful. That blue rectangular icon guides behavior, and it hides a complex reality that we don't need to know. And see, that's the key idea. Evolution has shaped us with perceptions that allow us to survive. They guide adaptive behaviors, but part of that involves hiding from us the stuff that we don't need to know. In other words, we see the square-shaped blue icon on the right bottom-hand side of the screen. We don't see all of the programming, all of the machinery behind that screen, everything with its inner workings that constitutes the reality when we click and open that program. Hoffman says, that's pretty much all of reality, whatever reality might be. If you had to spend all that time figuring it out, the tiger would have eaten you. So he's asked, everything then is a big illusion? He says, well, we've been shaped to have perceptions that keep us alive, so we have to take them seriously. If I see something that I think of as a snake, I don't pick it up. If I see a train, I don't step in front of it. I've evolved these symbols to keep me alive, so I have to take them seriously. But it's a logical flaw to think that if we have to take it seriously, we also have to take it literally. The final question, at least for this segment, if snakes aren't snakes and trains aren't trains, then what are they? And Hoffman says, snakes and trains, like the particles of physics, have no objective observer-independent features. The snake I see is a description created by my sensory system to inform me of the fitness consequences of my actions. Evolution shapes acceptable solutions, not optimal ones. A snake is an acceptable solution to the problem of telling me how to act in a situation. My snakes and trains are my mental representations. Your snakes and trains are your mental representations. I'm sure that there are probably a few brains out there that are hurting right now. So what about reality that we perceive on a daily basis actually is the reality that we see? I think that it's not only a logical question, but more and more people are asking it. Reality may not be what it appears to be at all. We'll wrap things up on the other side of this break. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, wrapping up this week's edition of the program. Info at MicahHanks.com. Follow me on Twitter at Micah Hanks. I'll leave you with this. And be sure and stay tuned after this for Richard Dolan, Jimmy Church a little bit later on tonight. There was a 2,400-year-old mosaic discovered during excavations in Turkey's southern Hatay province, apparently showing a skeleton lying down with a jorum in its hand and a wine pitcher and bread on the side. This mosaic, which is reportedly from the 3rd century BCE, was first discovered in 2012 when municipality officials were carrying out work to build a cable car in the Antakya and found the ancient remains. Excavations were then launched to search the area for more remains, and according to archaeologist Demet Kara with Hatay Archaeology Museum, the mosaic is part of an ancient Greek and Roman city of Antioch that has an ancient Greek inscription on it. Kara further noted that professors have referred to the mosaic as the skeleton mosaic and had concluded that the mosaic belonged to the dining room of a house belonging to the upper class back then. She noted that there is a similar mosaic in Italy, but this one is more comprehensive, making the one discovered recently a very unique piece. The ancient city of Antioch was established by one of Alexander the Great's generals. As far back as the 4th century BCE, it is known to be the first place where the followers of Jesus were actually referred to as Christians. But as far as this message that appeared on the mosaic, it is one that will resound throughout the ages, one that you should take to heart, and it was very simple. Be cheerful and enjoy your life. That's the final message that I will impart to you on this week's dispatch. It is the Graylian Report, and know that wherever you may go, wherever you may be, you are not alone in space-time. I will remain your friendly neighborhood doctor here in the dark hollow earth. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, Dick Oakley, Rayson Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, I am Micah Hanks. Email me info@MicahHanks.com and follow me on Twitter at Micah Hanks. Be sure and tune into this program wherever you may be able to find it online and help support what we do by spreading the good word of the Graylian Report. I bid you adieu once again, my friends. Take care out there. And as always, in the meantime, stay strange. We'll talk to you again next week.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website GraylianReport.com.